Kajala Medical presents COVID-19 The Answers, the show that delivers the scientific, evidence-based knowledge that can safely return us all to our pre-COVID lives. My name is Dr. Fumi Okanola, and I'll be hosting the show. Every week, you can listen to me interview a highly respected professional about the science that can reduce your risk of becoming infected with this coronavirus. Welcome to episode 6 of COVID-19 The Answers, titled The Vaccination of the Indigenous People of Canada and the Effects of COVID-19 on the Indigenous People of Canada. I'd like to introduce you all to Dr. Evan Adams. Dr. Adams is from the Tlamin First Nation near Powell River in British Columbia, Canada. Dr. Adams completed his Doctor of Medicine degree at the University of Calgary and his Aboriginal family practice residency at St. Paul's Hospital, UBC in Vancouver, Canada, as chief resident. He then went on to acquire a Master's of Public Health degree from Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore in the USA. He was the first ever Aboriginal Health Physician Advisor in the Office of the Provincial Health Officer and became the Deputy for Provincial Health Officer in the province of British Columbia, Canada. In 2014, he became the first Chief Medical Officer for the newly formed First Nations Health Authority in BC. Dr. Adams is currently the Deputy Chief Medical Officer for Indigenous Services Canada. Dr. Adams is a multi-award-winning actor, most famously starring as Thomas Builds the Fire in the movie Smoke Signals, and has over 30 years' experience as a motivational speaker. Dr. Evan Adams is one of the most famous, honoured, and much-loved persons amongst the Indigenous people of Canada. Welcome.
Thank you. What a very generous introduction.
Oh, it's very true. I've spoken to many Indigenous people, and I hear nothing but high praise.
That's a nice feeling. Thank you.
So I've been dying to ask how a medical physician came to be a famous actor. And did you have to choose between the two professions?
Yeah, it actually happened the other way around. I was a fairly good student, and you know, as a high school student was told, oh, we so need you to get an education and return home and help with all of those issues. And I think as a young person, that's pretty daunting. And so when I was in university, I was studying biochemistry. In my second year, a woman came up to me on the street and she said, are you an actor? And I just said, yes. She said, come and read for me tomorrow. And I did, and I was cast in the second lead in a film, and it was actually quite wonderful. I thought, oh, this is really fun. It's much better than the drudgery and the burden of training and going home and serving. It's just really light fun. But of course, I did it with all my heart, and I was, I think, 18. I looked 16. I thought I was, akin to an English major or a performance artist, and I just kept working. But by the time I hit 30, I thought, oh, I better go back to my original dream before I age out and see if I can do it. So here I am. I've done them both, and it's been really quite a journey.
That is fantastic and a real inspiration to lots of other students. I mean, I often tell people now, you know, you can have more than one career, and that's just a great story. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. And I hope it does encourage people to at the very least recognize that we all play many roles, right? Like we don't just want to be good at our one profession. We all have, we want to be a good person. We want to be a good partner. We want to be a good parent. We want to be clear, honest, authentic, right? There are lots of goals. And I feel like sometimes we're raised up just for excellence in work. And that's just not enough.
Yes. And I think when you've had those sorts of experience, it gives you breadth and depth of character too, and helps you to relate to people better.
Yes. And it's also humbling, which is very important. I think it's important for people to not position themselves as a subject matter experts or as de facto experts, right? As physicians, we can think of ourselves as godlike. I always joke, doctors, they're just like people. And I really want to avoid that, especially, of course, with my people, who I was seeing as patients, but now take take care of as a public health doctor. I needed to be seen as really quite approachable and not as, you know, some fancy doctor coming from a faraway city who was, you know, going to institute, you know, things that were not helpful or meaningful to them.
Indeed. We have an international as well as a national audience, so I thought I'd start the program with a definition of Indigenous people and communities pulled from the Canadian government website. Indigenous peoples is a collective name for the original peoples of North America and their descendants. Often Aboriginal peoples is also used. The Canadian Constitution recognizes three groups of Aboriginal peoples: Indians, more commonly referred to as First Nations, Inuit, and Métis. These are three distinct peoples with unique histories, languages, cultural practices, and spiritual beliefs. More than 1.6 million people in Canada identify themselves as an Aboriginal person, according to the 2016 census. Aboriginal peoples are the fastest growing population in Canada. They grew by 42.5% between 2006 and 2016. And the youngest population in Canada, about 44% were under the age of 25 in 2016. There are more than 630 First Nation communities in Canada, which represent more than 50 nations and 50 Indigenous languages. Evan, is there anything that you'd like to add to that statement?
Yeah, I think, you know, the United Nations and the World Health Organization speaks of at least 80 countries that have original peoples and Indigenous populations who are affected by waves of migration. And migration is not a bad word. We have feet. We're not barnacles. People go to different places and set up their homes, but sometimes for Indigenous peoples, the commonalities between us, you know, we're not DNA cousins, but we're cousins by our colonial experience. And so definitely in Canada, Indigenous peoples, you know, their health was going in one direction, health interrupted, and now it's going in another direction. And we actually have the worst health of any ethnic group in the country, in our own territories.
Right. That's sobering. So, moving on to the questions, I think it's important for our international audience to understand some of the nefarious history between the Canadian government and the Indigenous people of Canada. Although this was well known for decades within Indigenous communities, the recent discoveries of mass graves at past residential school sites across Canada has cast a spotlight on the treatment of Indigenous people here across generations, which frankly a significant proportion of the general public were ignorant of. In order to try to understand the mindset and lack of trust within the Indigenous community for Canadian governmental systems, can you please provide some of the background of the racist and genocidal practices perpetrated by the colonial system to the Indigenous people of Canada?
Thanks. And I think of colonization in many other countries that are kind of illustrative of, you know, what was happening here. There were Indigenous peoples all over the Americas, including, of course, Central and South America. And I think of places like Hawaii, Tahiti, and of course, there are many other places. I mean, you could even say the experiences of Indians or of Africans, you know, they're quite violent histories where people were subjugated and their lands and wealth went from them to other hands. And that was really essentially the case here. Indigenous peoples in Canada had to live under what was called the Indian Act. And there was no other act for any other ethnic group, just for us. And let's not be naive. Part of it was to separate us from our lands and to contain us, put us on reserves or reservations. And part of that was an attempt by the Canadian government in allyship with many churches to take children from their Indigenous families, to institutionalize them and to try and get them to forget where they were from and to accept a different way of being and knowing. And those places, residential schools, and they weren't really schools, they were really much more like like prisons had very high fatality rates and many, many children died. So now Canada's gone through a process of trying to reconcile what has happened, lest we forget. And we are finding all kinds of unmarked graves with thousands of children's bodies. And we as a nation have to deal with and ask, what happened? Who are we that this could occur in this country? Because I think Canadians are proud of themselves on the international stage. Canadians like to think of themselves as being a fair people, but you know, this is definitely a stain in their history. And for us, my parents went to residential school. For us, it is definitely a reckoning as well. Like, what does this mean for us in our own lands?
Evan, you were the first chief medical officer for the First Nations Health Authority in Canada, based in British Columbia, the only health organization in Canada set up to directly provide health services to First Nation people by First Nation people. Can you please tell the audience why this was set up?
Sure. The health system or health setup for Canadian citizens is delivered by our provinces. However, for Indigenous people, their healthcare system was created separately and was seen as a federal system. So around all other Canadians, except for maybe the armed forces, around all other Canadians, and prisoners too, they're considered federal subjects. They would have hospitals and physicians employed by their provinces. But we would have this separate system, or we did have this separate system run by the federal government. And it was exceedingly inefficient to have healthcare delivered from the capital city, Ottawa, a few thousand miles away, or from the provincial capital, hundreds of miles away, or kilometers away. And so we enacted in our province and amongst the Indigenous peoples in BC, a system that was run by us, essentially. So a large First Nations health service organization created to help Indigenous peoples, particularly First Nations peoples, to be better. And it really has been quite an important step in self-determination, in improving outcomes, achieving equity in service. And I think as well, having people be less subjugated and participate more in their own wellness, but also in society as well.
Could you tell us about your 2-year secondment to Indigenous Services Canada and your role as Deputy Chief Medical Officer? Were you invited to take up this role?
When I was at the First Nations Health Authority and serving the First Nations people of British Columbia and working as a really a public health official, as a physician with authority to vocalize and direct care and attention to specific areas like mental health or exploitation of women or substance use, that was really a lovely piece. I did that for many, many years, but I did feel like there was more work to be done in other areas, and I feel like the pandemic gave me an opportunity to say, well, let me go federally, let me work nationally and work on all things COVID, because actually, like everywhere, many healthcare workers and other workers were being redeployed to deal with COVID issues. So really, in a way, and I asked for this, I was redeployed and sent to a national position in our national capital in Ottawa.
So moving on to the COVID vaccination of the Indigenous people of Canada. The reason why I wanted to do this interview, amongst others, is to highlight the marvelous achievement that you were part of with regards to the scale-up and execution of the National COVID Vaccination Program for the Indigenous people of Canada. You achieved an 80% two-shot vaccination rate on reserves up to a year before this was achieved nationally. The vaccination program involved a brand new vaccine formulated from mRNA technology. Indigenous people have endured significant human rights abuses from the Canadian medical system as a result of historical colonial practices and continue to suffer racism in the health system. Prior to the arrival of the COVID vaccines, what medical, psychological, and social impacts did COVID-19 have on Indigenous communities?
Yes, the pandemic was absolutely frightening for all of us, particularly for our small communities. We have many small communities, about 650 different First Nations communities in Canada. Many of them are quite remote. And because of their remoteness and their size, they don't have tertiary care. So they were identified quite early on as being vulnerable just on a geographic basis. If they got COVID, they would have very few means to help anyone there, to stop an outbreak or to care for those who were sick. Of course, there were other risk factors that we brought forward, a number of us, and my team included, where we said Indigenous people have the poorest health of anyone. So, they do have elevated risk compared to the average Canadian. We have a special relationship with the Crown, with the country of Canada. So we're actually different from other marginalized groups. Chiefs, our leaders, were clear that in their relationship, the health of our peoples was important. And this happened in many countries. This happened in Hawaii, in the United States, in New Zealand, in Australia. Those countries named their Indigenous peoples as having special risk. And so they were given more of a priority than the average citizen in those countries. So we did that here. We got the word out that we would have, some availability of the vaccine eventually. Our people did really well at the beginning because we're so remote, and in part because we protected our borders. We protected our communities from importation. We actually literally set up roadblocks and asked people's business going in and out of our tiny communities. Eventually, our infection rate and our mortality rate and our complication rate were worse than other Canadians, about 2.5 times worse, roughly, from the data that we have. We did push hard in communities, and we said, please, let's look after each other. We can't afford to do badly at this time. We've had a long history of communicable diseases that were very bad for us, including smallpox and tuberculosis, and even modern scourges like HIV. And also, we had been already giving health messages to our people. We talked it up. We encouraged people to be vaccinated. We did fairly well, even though in my mind, I would like to do better.
No, you did remarkably well. Indigenous communities in Canada have specific experiences via provincial, territorial, and local public health systems concerning the management of their health and access to vaccines in past pandemics. Could you please tell the audience about their experiences of the H1N1 pandemic back in 2009 and the lessons learned?
Thanks. Yes, I was in charge of the Indigenous response to H1N1 in 2009 in my province. I was working provincially then. Remember, my previous job was with First Nations in BC, but my job before that was with the province of BC, looking after Indigenous peoples. So H1N1 happened, and again, we were nervous about what would happen to us. We knew that our communities were not prepared, much less prepared than they were this time around. For instance, they did have communicable disease and pandemic plans at a community level, but almost no one knew them. They were on a shelf collecting dust. Large-scale pandemics was not really front of mind for those little tiny communities that were having struggles in lots of other ways. So we knew that they needed help, and so I was part of a team provincially. Remember, our services are delivered provincially, including public health services. So we would work with those, largely those public health teams, to make sure that communities were ready. My gosh, that was a We were so lucky. We did everything we could, but we were so lucky that ultimately H1N1 wasn't that bad, I guess you could say. It could have been a lot worse.
Mm. So what did you learn from that experience that helped channel your sort of management of COVID-19?
Well, in BC, we learned that we needed to cooperate with the province, that First Nations needed to cooperate with the province. We knew that public health centers, those local public health centers, needed to take us into consideration. They didn't even know, for instance, sometimes that they needed to vaccinate us, that was their job, that, you know, they thought they were vaccinating everyone else. But when it came to us, they thought, oh, well, really, we have to do that. We have to speak to those people or go to those communities and vaccinate. We didn't know that. So we'd have to like literally go and tell them and explain, well, here's why you need to go over there. so that was part of it. But also we needed to make sure that communities understood their pandemic plans. So that it was quite a lot of work to engage those health workers, those Indigenous leaders, another pandemic could happen and we need to be ready. And we spent a lot of time there. And lo and behold, my gosh, COVID happened 11 years after H1N1. And the Indigenous communities in BC, I think, were pretty ready.
Yes. Gosh, that's astonishing what you said about how public health didn't realize their responsibilities. Now, let's contrast the previous pandemic experiences of the Indigenous community to the current COVID pandemic. Several working groups were set up by the Government of Canada to facilitate the success of the COVID-19 vaccine program for Indigenous communities. Evan, could you please describe the work of the Indigenous Services Canada, or ISC-led COVID-19 vaccine planning working group?
Sure. Indigenous Services Canada was, most importantly, part of the federal family. So we would be in the same meetings as Health Canada or the Canadian Armed Forces. We would interact with the National Association, basically the National Immunization Committee. And we would hear what they were planning, and we would be able to say, oh, and remember, First Nations, Inuit, and Métis, wherever they are, need to be included, and not just included, but prioritized. A lot of the operational stuff of getting vaccine paid for and then sent out from where they were being manufactured to major cities and then flown or driven out to our communities, you know, was quite a piece. I think of it as being a bit like a military campaign. It was that operational. And so we were making sure that we were in on that every step of the way, as in sometimes local public health wasn't sure how to get vaccines in arms of our citizens in our communities that were, you know, several kilometers or dozens of kilometers away from them. They hadn't been vaccinating us in the past, so how did they vaccinate us now? How did they count our cases? How did they report on those cases? We wanted to be involved in that data gathering and reporting. So, yeah, there was definitely a lot of coordination to do, and my team absolutely helped with that. And part of our work too was to assist with messaging, core messaging that needed to go out to all Indigenous peoples in the country, even though much of that work was being done at a local level, at a regional level, or a provincial territorial level. Yeah, it was a lot.
Mm. One of the many challenges of the ISC COVID-19 vaccine plan must have been accessing communities in remote and isolated regions of Canada, such as the Yukon and the Northwest Territories, and parts of Ontario, Alberta, Manitoba, and Quebec. To give the audience some background, these regions can have infrequent flights, roads can be interrupted by weather conditions, and there can at times be no roads in or out of the community. Internet access can be slow or absent, and there can be infrequent radio and phone connection. How did ISC overcome these challenges and provide COVID vaccination support to First Nations, Inuit and Métis communities in these remote areas?
Now, we just made sure that we were in every part of the operation. We were keeping an eye on hundreds of communities and hundreds of deliveries, and they would each have their unique challenges. And we weren't like solely responsible, for instance, for getting that small plane to go to that small community. We were a part of it. So we would be helping with coordination and planning, and we would send nurses up. We would be part of reassuring communities. Yes, the vaccine will be there on time. It'll be here. It'll be there on that date. If you need extra vaccinators, we'll send them up. Or if they were having an outbreak, how are you doing? Are you getting a bit overwhelmed? Should we send you respite? Do you need, is it so bad? Do we need to send the Canadian Armed Forces? Do we need to send the Red Cross? So basically, we were in touch with all of those communities as they were going through COVID. And even checking in and saying, how are you doing mentally and spiritually? Like, do you need those kinds of supports? Should we send counselors to help with mental wellness? Is your community straining? Are they having, for instance, deaths? Have you lost elders? Are you having runs of suicides? We will assist. And again, we weren't the only game in town. There were many, many helpers, but we we were Indigenous Services Canada, seen as an important part of the effort, and often would play a leadership role, but in coordination with local leaders, because the local leaders, if they didn't like us or they didn't want us there, they could very easily keep us out. So we definitely had to be diplomatic and say, no, we're here to help. You can count on us.
What a fabulous response. So I saw some figures about a year ago, you may be able to update me, that vaccination of Indigenous people living off reserve or away from their communities, particularly in urban areas, hasn't been as successful. Could you describe the challenges that are faced with getting this group of people COVID vaccinated?
Yes, our people in the cities have special risks because they're not in our villages amongst their family members, and where there's a social network, right? A community center, a nursing center, resources to support them. They're away. They're in the city. In the city, I would say they're probably not treated as well as they could be. Many of them are impoverished or marginalized in the cities. There are often inner city portions where many of our people with mental health and substance use issues are underhoused and exploited, and the cities can be unkind, and also the cities may not give them neighborhoods or collections of Indigenous people who support each other and live together. So we have a city site where there are a hodgepodge of Indigenous peoples living here and there, disconnected from each other, disenfranchised, poor, often with social issues that create obstacles for us vaccinating or accessing or caring for them. And we would have to call on local services. We would call on local chiefs. What can we do? How do we help with these efforts? Often the city itself, where those Indigenous people were, and the province or territory that they were in had some responsibility. In fact, they would say, "Well, they're off reserve peoples. We're supposed to help look after them, because my agency spends, for better or for worse, a little more time in our communities, like on reserve, than they do off reserve." So there was a lot again to coordinate. There were a lot of challenges, and luckily, a lot of our agencies in the cities stepped up and said, "We will help."
Good. Moving on to the effects of COVID-19 on the Indigenous people of Canada, I'd like to delve deeper and explore the direct and indirect effect of COVID-19 in Indigenous communities now that we are 2 years into the global COVID-19 pandemic. At present, as you've already mentioned, the rate of active COVID-19 cases recorded in Indigenous communities living on reserve is double that of the overall Canadian population. Yet just a few minutes ago, we explained how a two-shot COVID immunization was a huge success in the Indigenous community on reserve with an 80% vaccination rate. Do you have any theories as to why the increased rate of COVID cases is occurring?
Yes. Because we have the poorest health of any ethnic group in the country, and because the social determinants of health are poorer in our communities, generally, we did worse. So, for instance, you can imagine in the north, where there are lots of housing challenges, if one member of the family got COVID, many others would get it, and they would be far from care. They would bar from public health personnel who could assist, like with contact tracing or moving them towards vaccination really quickly. They would be away from centers that had been converted to care for persons with COVID, because not every hospital, right, was equipped to deal with COVID. Only certain ones, you know, there are only a few at the beginning, many more at the end, but our people would have difficulty accessing them because of their geographic challenges, but also social challenges means that it can be harder for them to move towards care and help. So there were lots of for instance, not even having great water for hygiene, you know, for washing and cleaning surfaces, could be a problem. And for many of our communities, because they're northern. They're indoors more. We supposition that maybe the transmission rate was worse. So we did see that our infection rate was quite high, but we also noted that our complication rate was lower, like around three quarters that of other Canadians. So our hospitalization rate, even though we had twice as many people infected. We had about three quarters the rate of other Canadians for hospitalization and death. And we don't know what that's about.
That's interesting. That sounds like a research project that should happen in the making. The Omicron wave has been particularly prevalent and destructive worldwide, leading to the highest hospitalization rates and deaths than any of the other variants. What are your own personal experiences of this occurrence in Indigenous communities?
Gosh. So my office, along with others, of course, but we were at the center of intel as it was coming in. We were walking over communities, and we would hear very quickly when a community was affected. So we would keep counts of how many people were active cases, how many of our people were new cases, how many of our people were hospitalized, how many had died that day, and we would see the numbers increase. We would keep track of what we called communities of concern, communities that had high numbers, more than 10 cases in the village at any given time, and that we would see that number start to grow. Community leaders as well would call us and say, just in case you didn't see the stat, we're in trouble here. We need some help. We'll need some support. We're going to be calling you. We're going to be calling you often about what's happening here on the ground. So it did feel like we felt the waves. Like we literally felt the waves in our bones, because it would get to be bone crushing, very time-consuming work when a lot of our communities had a lot of cases. So Omicron was quite a large wave, and we were all tired by the time Omicron occurred. We started to talk about, we really are much less concerned with mild cases, because Omicron did have a number of mild cases, and more concerned about the hospitalized cases, for sure. We started to talk about long COVID. You know, were those mild cases truly mild? Maybe they were mild for the first several days, but really, were there sequelae, and do we need to keep track of those people who, in the acute setting, we weren't watching over? So that's what happened.
Gosh.
From my understanding, women and children are being particularly affected by COVID-19 in Indigenous communities. Evan, could you please explain why?
Yeah, that was a surprising piece that we saw in our data, was that women and children were much more affected than other age groups. Generally, all of our age groups had higher numbers, but we saw it particularly so with children and with women. We suppositioned that, well, because we have so many children, like where our populations are really young, and that perhaps children are overly affected by the social determinants of health, like younger families perhaps have poorer housing, or they're just poorer in general. They don't have the resources of older people. We supposition maybe because they went to schools, or because they were much more social than older groups. We supposition that women, because women are caregivers, or the heads of families, and thus had to go out and take risks, go to the store, or go to work, ride the bus, pick up their children at school. That maybe that's why that was occurring. We also had this other perhaps notion that maybe the men were, we use this expression, cowboys. They were too macho to go and get tested, and so maybe we undercounted them. These are all just theories about why we saw that.
What have been the economic consequences of COVID-19 in Indigenous communities? How has ISC stepped in to help alleviate these burdens?
Yeah, so Indigenous Services Canada did set up a few funds that were COVID-related that had very loose parameters on them, so people could use them easily and freely when they needed them. We, at the beginning, up until, I would say, weeks ago, we did not hear communities saying that we were having other effects from COVID than infection. They weren't saying to us, we've had a loss of revenue, we don't need food stamps, food security stamps. We weren't hearing that. We didn't hear that families were in trouble economically, or that people's opportunity for work was affected. We did hear, of course, that their opportunity for education was affected, but everyone was talking about that. So yeah, we were surprised. We're hearing it now. Prices are rising. People don't have the resources to cope now, and we're getting requests for financial assistance. So with those starting to come in, we are definitely reacting to see how we can do the very best that we can. Would the tactic be, for instance, food security? Would the tactic be a fund like the former COVID fund, even though it's not directly related to COVID at the moment, like something like a COVID fund? Would we need to do something local, because the food security is partly dependent on geography, right? How does food get delivered? Can food grow in your northern or southern community? And so maybe a regional response would be most appropriate. So we're, again, as tired as we are, seeking to help. And I think we're going to hear more and more, not just from Indigenous people, but from around the world, some of those indirect consequences of COVID. We're in a very active recovery phase, and recovery doesn't mean just physical recovery at all. It means lots of different kinds of recovery.
While we would all love to get back to pre-COVID life, we have all endured strict governmental, particularly public health measures, these last 2 years. Now, society is being told by government agencies to live with the coronavirus and encouraged to believe that we are entering an endemic phase on the back end of the pandemic. Many of the medics and scientists I speak to regularly recognize that we are clearly still in a global COVID-19 pandemic. This is confusing mixed messaging for anyone. In your opinion, what effect is this change in public health policy and attitude having on Indigenous communities?
It's been a very difficult time for us to reach this point of opening up. And it is in part because of COVID fatigue. It is in part because of politics, you know, political leaders who are not health leaders or health experts, political leaders saying we need to open up. It's partly economic. We need to get back to work, get back to school in spite of the risk. You know, the safest thing to do is to stay home and to see no one, but maybe that's not something that's sustainable. On the other hand, for us in public health, we're really worried about the next wave, that this opening up all over the world, we're getting some signals that there can be some large-scale outbreaks and another wave because of the opening up. And of course, there's still the specter of other variants of concern that we will have to react to, and the re-imposition of those public health measures. So, you know, I'm a health person. I'm much more concerned with human health than, say, economic recovery. Economic recovery is not my job, or how much politicians are liked or not liked because of public health measures is not my work. So definitely from my point of view, we need to continue to be cautious. And we have been saying to individual communities, we know that your provinces and territories and towns nearby are opening up, but it's up to you. And you might want to consider how much COVID is around you, how much you have to lose, because, you know, protect your knowledge keepers and your elders and your babies, please, you know, that they could go slower if they so chose to do that.
Last week, we discussed the impact of school closures during lockdowns on children's education, safety, and health. Women and children can be particularly vulnerable to abuse in these scenarios. What has been done to support Indigenous communities with regards to safeguarding of education and protection from abuse?
Those are really good questions. Family violence and women's health are part of our team. They are not directly involved in the COVID response. However, chiefs and community leaders have already identified family violence and the risk to women and children, and the mental health risks like suicidality in young people as being major concerns for them. And they've been saying that since the 80s. So there are programs in place. There are personnel whose job is exactly that, the safety of families to respond to mental health crises, to offer counseling and assistance. So those teams are already in place. However, as we all know, services were quite interrupted by COVID. So even though violence and mental health were getting worse, services were pulled back, or they couldn't be delivered in the way that they used to be. So you can assume that there was much more suffering during the pandemic than there was before. Again, the leaders would say that to us at all of our meetings. They would say, and not only are we worried about COVID, but our people are straining, and you know, bad things are happening. So we would continue to offer our mental health services, continue to try and respond to particular places of concern. And you know, it's not like all of the communities were doing badly all at once. Some communities would be doing badly, and then the next month it would be a totally different group of communities that were doing badly because of their particular circumstances. So I think once we go back and we look at what happened, I do suspect that we will say, some bad stuff happened, and people are starting to talk about how bad it was, and maybe we could have done things in a different way so that there was more safety than was available on the day.
Mm. So that's something to build on, I guess.
Yes, and I think it's important, and it's okay for us to say, yeah, we could do better, or we could have done better. Because for me, I mean, any woman or child or family under threat is one too many. And so, you know, there were a number of our families that were under duress who probably could have done with better help. And our, you know, our services were not as good as they were before COVID. So is there something more that we could have done? I think that'll be part of the analysis. And I think we will learn to do better. I know when I was with the First Nations Health Authority in BC, for instance, we had quite large mental health teams, and that they evolved to have a kind of roving function. They would go where they were needed. So rather than, you know, one worker in one community and another worker in another community, those mental health workers could band together and say, oh, look, the trouble is over there. Let's a few of us go over there and respond. And then if there's another, if we're needed somewhere else at a different location, we'll go to that other location. So that seems, you know, to be a sensible model. But there will be other teammates and stakeholders, I think, who will help shape mental health in the future. Definitely, it has been seen as an issue. So, for instance, the Canadian government newly created a ministry just several months ago, a ministry of mental health, and it deals with exactly these kinds of issues and substance use as well.
Well, that's welcome to hear. And I think that's one of the positive things to come out of the pandemic, that, you know, mental health isn't going to be as stigmatized, because it seems that everybody has suffered mentally. And I think some of the challenges that you've experienced in Indigenous communities with retraction of supports has happened universally everywhere. But looking forward, we started on a positive note, highlighting that your successful vaccination rollout in the Indigenous community. And now I'd like to end on a positive note. The cooperation and organization of governmental agencies with the leaders and healthcare workers of the Indigenous communities in Canada to deliver COVID vaccines appears to be unprecedented. What future projects and programs can be built on this new attitude and possible infrastructure that will really benefit Indigenous people and their healthcare?
Yes, COVID definitely highlighted weaknesses within the system. So, for instance, there can be a lack of cooperation between an Indigenous village and provincial health staff. Our national public health data system could absolutely use improvements. And each province and territory is kind of idiosyncratic in how they collect data and then share that data, like share it with other provinces and territories, or share it with the federal government, or share it with other data holders and match those data. So for instance, a First Nations membership list and provincial hospital data could be matched, and you could get a sense of First Nations hospitalizations. So by and large, that kind of sharing absolutely could be improved. But I think the bottom line is that we've seen we have to speak to each other. The worst scenario is poor people or marginalized people are left to manage their own marginalization or their own poverty. The best case scenario is everyone shows up and says, we absolutely need to do this. No one left behind. Equity is a goal. Equity of service, but also equity of outcome. In fact, during the pandemic, we talked about that becoming a law, not just something that would be nice, but something that would be a requirement, that every system, like say, a hospital, would have equity as a goal. You know, is your transplantation rate for whites the same as it is for Blacks, as it is for Indigenous people? Are you serving people in the same way? So for instance, studies around pain control. Is the pain control that you're meeting out for white Canadians or the white people in your neighborhood the same as for Black or Indigenous people? You know, those are important questions that we can have at the table when all the stakeholders are together. the old way of doing business is, for instance, a premier, not a premier of the province, refusing to meet with Indigenous peoples or leaders and, you know, not have their needs enunciated or recorded or responded to. And that definitely used to happen. So we can get better. We can get better at that. And I think we've named that. And we've named public health data collection as you know, very clear goals that we just have to attain. We can't keep leaving people out or leaving them behind.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Adams. It's been a real pleasure to hear your thoughts and opinions and experiences of the COVID-19 pandemic and to provide a voice for Indigenous communities, because personally, as one of my main drivers for having this podcast is I haven't heard the Indigenous voice in COVID-19. And thank you so much for being such an honoured and well-loved representative off that voice.
You're so kind, and thank you for the opportunity to speak at this level. I almost never get to describe what this work is like, and it is definitely difficult to be included in this kind of work and this kind of response, right? It's been a challenge, but I can definitely sleep at night that, you know, I'm going to do good things.
Yes, so, thank you. And so many people are so grateful for it.
Thank you so much.
Please join us next week for episode 7, entitled Testing in the Saliva Direct Story. Thanks for listening to this week's episode of COVID-19 The Answers. If you enjoyed the episode, please subscribe, rate and review, and do visit our website kajalamedical.com/COVID-19 The Answers.